Some scientists believe you can take the measure of famous minds by actually measuring the size of their brains. University of Chicago economist David Gallanson also thinks you can measure how great minds operate, but in a little different way. He says he can tell you how the great modernist painters thought and worked by measuring their textbook citations and their auction sales.
I basically took auction data from the last 30 years and simply said, at what point in this person's life did they do the paintings that would then become the most expensive paintings when they were sold at auction? And I discovered that of the major modern artists, some of them did their most important work after decades of experience, and others did what would become their most valuable work very early in their careers.
Gallanson's new book is called Painting Outside the Lines. He charts dozens of 19th and 20th century painters and separates the young bucks from the veteran workhorses. He also surveys art history books and says he's not surprised to learn that scholars, like art buyers, consistently seem to value some parts of major artists' careers over others. At the same time, Gallanson also notices another pattern surrounding one of his favorite paintings, George Seurat's pastel pixelated masterpiece, Sunday Afternoon on La Grande Jatte.
Why is it that Seurat has a painting that appears in virtually every book, whereas in contrast, Cézanne has more paintings illustrated in the textbooks than any other artist who worked in 19th century France, but that there's no one painting that appears frequently in those books? So why is it that a relatively minor artist created a painting that was much more famous than any work by the much greater artist?
Gallanson believes his columns of numbers, when backed up with biographical research, systematically quantify artistic genius. His grand unified theory is that there are two types of artists. Late bloomers like Cézanne are, quote, experimental innovators. They're traditionally trained, they don't have single pinnacle artworks, they use trial and error and take decades to solve visual problems, like light or perspective. The other type, early bloomers like Picasso or Seurat, are, quote, conceptual innovators. They make sudden, cataclysmic breakthroughs. They challenge the very nature of art and sometimes generate greatest hits paintings that end up in every anthology. Gallanson's perhaps biggest find, however, is how art historians have utterly refused to consider either his methods or his conclusions. Professor Jeff Hardwick studies visual culture in museums at Temple University.
His emphasis that the conceptual innovators are about ideas and the experimenters are more about the visual, it just seems too overarching. That, yes, you can find nice quotes from both of them saying that, but I imagine you could also find Andy Warhol saying, you know, he's interested in color as much as he is interested in the idea of the Campbell soup can. And so where does that line get drawn then between these two camps?
Hardwick at least read the book, which is more than Gallanson says most other professors and journal editors have done. Hardwick doesn't even mind the graphs, tables, and numbers. In fact, he'd like more of them. He thinks Gallanson would do better with the art history establishment if Gallanson used numbers to connect artists to the world around them rather than just categorizing them by work style. For example, Hardwick says that when Gallanson's writing about Jackson Pollock, his statistics only tell part of the story of Pollock's meteoric rise in the 1940s and 50s.
There's all sorts of arguments about New York coming to prominence in the world of art, not so much because they have an incredible breakthrough, but more that they are able to have the weight of American power coming out of World War II behind them. It becomes easy for Life magazine to do a profile of Jackson Pollock because it's abstract, because it's a blank signifier in which people can project any meaning, not because it's a wonderfully new innovation, but because it sort of fits the moment in 1950s America.
Hardwick represents the new generation of social historians, and the irony is that Gallanson, for all his numbers, might just have more in common with the old guard traditionalists, the same ones who think he's trying to reduce artistry to actuarial tables. After all, Gallanson's systematic comparative study and multiple regression analysis are just ways his numerical mind wraps itself around the classic question his college art professors asked him all those years ago. What is the artist trying to say?
My work has changed my understanding of the way I answer that question, because now, instead of simply coming to the painting with my knowledge of, you know, who the painter is, I look and see when the painting was done. because what Picasso was trying to tell us at different stages of his career was very different, whereas what Cézanne was trying to tell us throughout a very long period was the same, but he couldn't tell it to us as well earlier as late.
Gallinson says he hopes his book will help readers look at how they themselves think, learn, and create, just as it's helped him assess his own work patterns. He generally thinks of himself as a slow and steady, trial-and-error experimenter, but he also thinks his latest work represents a breakthrough, and one that's already steeply increased the value curve of his career. For Studio 360, I'm Fred Mogul.
I'm Kurt Anderson in Studio 360 today with the actor and filmmaker Danica McKellar, and we're talking about various kinds of art and mathematics. Danica, Professor Gallinson also says, we didn't hear in that piece, but he also says that he can take certain measurements from an artist's life, like the lifelong auction prices for the work, and actually predict from that whether or not the artist made sketches before his paintings. Hollywood is obviously full of all kinds of even cruder formulas to measure talent and marketability, like the famous Q ratings of performers. Yep. Do you find any merit in those things, or the incredible research that's done before any film opens and the numbers that are assigned to audience reactions and things like that?
Well, films seem to be failing left and right, so practically speaking, it doesn't seem to be working very well. But in theory, I mean, sure, in that case, they're not measuring art. They're measuring what audiences are responding to in terms of, you know, stars and star power. And yeah, I guess that makes sense. If I were in charge of making sure that the studio's money was spent well, I would want to make sure that they was going to have a good draw and have a good opening weekend. That's only one side of filmmaking. Of course, you have to make sure you've got a quality film to bring in the people for the rest of the weekends after that. But yeah, I mean, you have to, I would imagine that that's very important. It's a very important tool to quantitatively measure the probable success of an opening weekend, because so much money is put into those films, and it costs so much money to advertise the films and to open.